Does it ever freak you out when the time display on your phone isn't centered? You know what I mean? Like, it's up in the left for some reason, you know, it's kind of off center. It's kind of like, it's not, it's like it's been like it was a cutout that was taped onto your phone or something, you know? Like, it freaks me out a little. Like, why does it do that? Like, it just seems off. Like, you know what I'm talking, you know what I'm talking about too. Yeah, it's weird. It's unsettling. It's like when your kids call you by your first name or some shit, right? It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I don't know. Maybe I'm blowing this out of proportion. I'm just trying to save some wee lives, you green cunt. You green cunt. I'm trying to save you the fucking life. But you're making me risk my life to go out and save your wee fucking green cunt life, lass. What are you saying, dude? Why are you talking like a Scottish guy? What's the matter with you? What's going on? I'll tell you what's going on. I'm going to tell you what's going on now. So I got this... So I'm listening to Vineland on audio. Why? Why would you do that? Why... I'll tell you why, if you just calm down. I'd read this blurb. You're a blurb. Evidently, supposedly, there's a film being filmed downtown here in Sacramento. And Paul Thomas Anderson is down there. He was down on the steps of the Capitol or something. And I guess he's doing a film version of the movie, or the book Vineland by Thomas Pynchon. So I thought to myself, what the fuck? I'm going to read this. Did I read that in college? I think I read it in college. No. Maybe. Possibly, I don't know, came out in 1990, and it takes place in I believe it's a fictional county. Thomas Pynchon, who is one of those odd writers that is kind of steeped in obscurity, or he's kind of a recluse, like J.D. Salinger. Nobody really sees him. Nobody really... he appeared on The Simpsons, but there was a bag over his head. So that you couldn't identify him. But he's that notorious. Like, it's so common. The common knowledge of him being kind of reclusive was kind of obviously the joke on The Simpsons. But he's one of these guys. I think he was like an engineering student in college, and then he wrote his first book was called V, and then it gained some notoriety, and then the big one, of course, was the second one, Gravity's Rainbow, which is kind of up there with, like, kind of on the scale of difficulty, it ranks up there with, like, Ulysses and you know, Blood Meridian and shit like that. Nobody really knows what's going on. And but this book, I think, came out, and it says 1990. I thought I read it in college, but it's set in California in 1984 during Reagan's re-election, and through flashbacks by its characters who lived kind of these hippie lives, and you know, the kind of 60s rejects, burnouts. They are living up in a fictional county called Vineland. I'm pretty sure, up in Humboldt County. They reference Humboldt County and the drug wars, and then this burnout character, this guy named Zoid Wheeler, who his notoriety is basically that of which he dives through plate glass windows annually, so that he can display his the notion that he's still crazy and collect his disability checks, right? So, and then it goes on kind of from there. It goes on kind of a whodunit, and which is odd. But I like the connection between the Central Valley, the California, Sacramento, Central Valley, and then the Humboldt County connection. And but I also thought it was interesting that Paul Thomas Anderson is doing another movie based on a Thomas Pynchon book. The other one being Inherent Vice, which he did with, what's his name, Joaquin Phoenix, who did a good, phenomenal job. Just weird movie, though. Weird movie, but it's a weird book. It's weird. It's got Martin Short as some deranged dentist, and then Joaquin Phoenix, and but it's kind of a whodunit. It's kind of like a, it's kind of like an overly complex version of, say, like The Big Lebowski, which itself was kind of loosely based on like a Raymond Chandler style novel, like I think The Big Sleep or something comparable to that. Which is funny because all these guys, regardless, are like, they become, even though they're great authors, writers, and storytellers with different backgrounds, they all kind of go to the whodunit, it seems like, you know? The Coen brothers, and they made Big Lebowski. They really like the whodunit type stuff. Pops up repeatedly, and like, you know, Barton Fink, Big Lebowski, Miller's Crossing, Blood Simple, you know. And the same can be said for Thomas Pynchon, the engineering student, which you may want to cross double check that. I don't know. I think that's what he, obviously a very smart guy, but I think I read it in college. I can't remember. But what's going on? How y'all doing? It's finally moving on, pressing on into this godforsaken year of 2024. We got us a leap year. We got us an Olympic year. We got us a election year. Oh, gas prices will probably be coming down pretty soon. You motherfuckers. You dirty bastards. I see the game you're playing. How was your weekend? What'd you do? Did you do anything? Was it worth talking about? Was it worth repeating to your buddy next door in the other cubicle about making a, you know, egg salad sandwich, and it just, you know, the epic 3-hour story about how you went down to the store and got the eggs and the mustard and the mayo, and then you know, the way you do it is by hand. You know, you don't use like a appliance, you know, and you really pace yourself. And then by the time you get done with it all, you're really kind of not in the mood for an egg salad sandwich. Was that your weekend? Was that the high point of your weekend? Was that rush hour? I'll tell you this, the weekend in between, football, there's always that weekend in between football, which is like the saddest weekend of your sad little pathetic life, isn't it? Why do they do that? Why do we have to have an open weekend in between? I think it used to be like for the Pro Bowl, but nobody even watches that anymore. Is that even a thing anymore? I guess the one game I probably won't watch. I don't watch it anymore. I never really used to watch it. It's the one bowl game. It's kind of pointless, you know? There's nobody out there really taking it that seriously. They're not doing like in the All-Star game with Pete Rose just knocking Ron Hassey, knocking his lights out at home plate like in the All-Star game or something, you know? Nobody cares, but But yet there's still that void of nothing, that emptiness, that bye weekend for everybody. You know, they go back to back to back to back to back 17 weekend, 18, 19 weekends. Then they go into postseason, and every weekend it's, if you're still in it, you got to play like fucking, you know. And but then they give you a weekend off before the Super Bowl. Like, what the fuck? Why do we got to do that? And incidentally, I'm speaking of the Super Bowl. My prediction, this is my wholehearted prediction, is it's going to be a tie. It's going to be an overtime tie, 6-6. That's what's going to happen. And I don't care. Because I'm already kind of burnt out on the Chiefs and the Niners. I hope they end in a tie, honestly, but it's good. Okay, so, all right, so you tried to make an egg salad sandwich, and then you got burnt out on the notion of making an egg salad sandwich, and that was your weekend, and I'm sorry, but, it's good that they, okay, so what I did, let me tell you what I did. It's been building up to this point. You're pretty excited. But they had the U.S. American Men's Olympic Marathon Team Trials to decide who's going to Paris this year, an Olympic year, leap year, Olympic year, election year. Who's going to Paris? Who's running the marathon? Who's going to represent the U.S.? And it's good. I think it's good that they scheduled the trials on the weekend in between the championships and the Super Bowl, because the amount of people climbing over each other to watch that marathon, I'm sure, is immeasurable. You know, people calling, thinking they got to call in, you know, work to get time off to watch this or something. But luckily, it's on an available weekend, right? And my prediction, I called the top two. Well, Clayton Young and Connor Mans went 1-2. And a couple of Mormons. We got us some Mormon representatives. So Connor Mans won the race. He ran 209.05. He'd already gone under the Olympic standard, which I believe is like 208.10, which is fucking like goddamn. And then Clayton Young, his Mormon stunt double, came in second at 209.06. And then third was Leonard Carrier, and he ran 209.57, but he still got to run another marathon to get under the Olympic standard, which fucking sucks. But otherwise, it was a pretty good race overall. Three guys ran under 210, and then there was a lot of guys, three more guys under 211, but the one glaring spot that didn't happen was Galen Rupp, who ended up, I think, 16th. Yeah, he ran 214. He was up with the leaders, and then he just faded in a bid for his fifth Olympic team, right? So I think he just ran out of, he's just out of gas. This guy, I mean, this guy's been going hard for 20 years, going hard. The Olympic silver medalist in 2012 in London. And then he was the Olympic bronze medalist in 2016 in Rio in the marathon. Getting second in the 10,000 was no easy feat either, because he could have, he almost could have won that. He got out kicked by his teammate, they were both coached by Alberto Salazar, Mo Farah, and who just has a devastating kick, just devastating. Like, I mean, that's what the guy was. I mean, he just is lethal. I think they ran like a 53 second last lap in that Olympic 10,000 meters, which is just no joke. Because I think they ran like 27:30, something like that. But anyway, yeah. So old Galen Rupp, I think he just out of juice, man. You know, five Olympics is a lot. That ain't that ain't no easy feat, right? For running, and I mean running specifically. Like if you're just shooting a gun, yeah, you can make like 20 Olympic teams. Like, I mean, Jesus Christ. But runners have a smaller window, it looks like. But so congratulations to those guys, Connor Mance and Clayton Young, and hopefully Leonard Carrier gets that standard, that Olympic standard. And in the women's race, it was Fiona O'Keefe, who it was her Olympic debut of all things. She must have, her qualifier must have been a half marathon. So in her first full marathon, she broke the trials record. She ran 2:22. She beat Joan Benoit's trials record, who Joan Benoit would go on to win the very first women's Olympic marathon in 84, which is odd to think like that was the first women's Olympic marathon. But and I guess they thought that women would explode if they ran that far prior to that. But it's getting harder to do. Like, I have to believe it's getting tougher to do some real, well, like in regard to like Galen Rupp, like he got second in 2012 in the 10,000 and in third in the marathon in 2016. Back in the day in 72, yeah, 72, Frank Shorter in the same Olympics got second in the 10,000 and won the Olympic marathon, which is ridiculous. Like, that's hard to do, but the guys were different back then. So comparably speaking, I mean, this is something that was comparable to what he, because people don't really do, like, that is a lot of, it's a lot to ask of somebody, because you got to run heats in the 10,000, you got to run heats. Even in the Olympics, it's your second, you know, it's your second 10,000 meter you're running if you make the final within a week, and then to run the marathon, like it, I don't know. This takes a different breed of person, but the women look good too, though. Emily Sisson, who I believe she's the women's American record holder, she's like a 2:18 marathoner. She ran second at 2:22:42, 32 seconds behind. Excuse me, Fiona O'Keefe. So they're good. Those are good competitive times. And then Dakota Lindworm, never even heard of her. Came out of nowhere, 2:25. Just ahead of fourth place, Jess McClain. And only 15 seconds separating the two of them. But congratulations to all of them. All of them. And they're on their way to Paris. They're on their way to Paris. Ba-da-da-da. 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 But after that was over, then what do you got? What else you got? I'll tell you. I happened upon, after I got back from making my rounds up in Grass Valley and checking in on Pops and having lunch with Moms, I got home and NFL Films presents dun 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 ba-dum, ba-dum, biddly, biddly, bum. Classic. And they had every Super Bowl, of course they would on the bye weekend, every Super Bowl from Chiefs Packers Super Bowl I. All the way to current, like, it's still going, and I picked it up at Super Bowl III with Namath beating the Colts 16-7 and calling it Broadway Joe, calling the win, and getting it, and then at that point, I just went on a friggin', it was a bender. That was a bender, an NFL Films bender. But those films are so well done. I mean, the music alone, I don't know what it is. There's something, because they go all the way to current, you know, up to present day Super Bowl competition. But somewhere in the 80s is when it kind of gets away from whoever was producing and directing those. And, you know, in the early, you know, in the 60s from Super Bowl One, man, so well done. The music was like, the music by itself is magnificent. It's very symphonic. It's very like a lot of horns, right? A lot of like, it's like they're like Bruce Brown films, you know, like the Endless Summer movies, you know, or something. That horn saturated symphonic sound, like kind of like Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, you know, that kind of, you know, kind of shadowy film, kind of a strange lens. That, of course, all these Super Bowls in the 60s, they all seem to either be in like Miami or New Orleans, some kind of sun, you know, warmer venue for January. And they're all in January. Now we're getting further and further on. We're like mid-February now. You know, pretty soon we'll be into March, you know, or April for the Super Bowl. But yeah, the music, you could almost use it like in a spaghetti western, right? It's like that kind of this epic, you know, it's the sound of an epic. The music is like a sound of an epic with these big horns and shadowy figures with like that January sun peeking through the stadium. And you got guys like, you know, Alan Page of the Vikings or Dan Reeves of the Cowboys, you know, in Super Bowl V. Dan Reeves, the future coach of the Broncos, was a running back for the Cowboys, and Craig Morton was the quarterback against Johnny Unitas. You know, all these old, you know, Walt Garrison, you know, these old school guys, Don Meredith. And so good, though. God damn. I just got locked in. I started Super Bowl III. After that one, it was Kansas City, Minnesota. Hank Stram's Chiefs versus Bud Grant's Vikings. Poor Vikings. Jesus. Those motherfuckers couldn't get a break. I mean, they were in a lot starting at Super Bowl IV. And then they were in... then they popped back up again in Super Bowl what? Against Miami in Super Bowl VIII? Yeah. In Houston. And then Super Bowl IX against Steelers. Then Super Bowl XI against the Raiders. Lost all of them. Lost everyone. Horrible. And that was it. That was a wrap. No more Minnesota. It was always Fran Tarkenton getting chased around by guys that were three times the size of him. And this is one of the greats, Fran Tarkenton. You know? I mean, he was I think he was the original, like, all-time yardage leader, passing yards, until, probably somebody like Favre kind of came along and broke that record. And then Manning came along and broke his record. And then Drew Brees came along, broke his record. And then Brady came along, broke his record. But Fran Tarkenton was the man. I mean, he was the original scrambler. They must have always just been... always must have been dominant. It must have always been like Dallas versus Vikings in the NFC Championship every year, you know? Because it was either Minnesota or Dallas. It seemed every year in the Super Bowl... from like Super Bowl IV on, yeah. Super Bowl V was Baltimore Dallas. Super Bowl VI was Dallas Miami. The only exception would be Super Bowl VII, would be Miami over Washington. That was the year that Miami went 17-0. And then back to Minnesota against Miami, and then Minnesota against Pittsburgh, then Dallas against Pittsburgh, then Minnesota against Oakland, then Dallas against Denver. Just so, which there were great big head-to-head competitions against, you know, you'd have, you know, Roger Staubach throwing miracle Hail Marys to Drew Pearson against the fucking Vikings in the NFC Championships, or vice versa. You'd have Fran Tarkenton throwing up, you know, long bombs downfield to Ahmad Rashad, who'd make those shoestring catches. It must have been just a wild time. But yeah, those teams were like, in essence, they were kind of gatekeepers, right? So that eventually evolved into like kind of dynastic teams, I guess, right? So like the 70s would have been, the 60s were kind of rough and tumble. The first Super Bowl was in 67, so there wasn't really any dynasty teams. I mean, I guess if you had to call it, the 60s would have been Green Bay, because they won the first two against Kansas City and Oakland, and then the Jets winning number three. But at that point, now we're in the 70s. So in the 70s, you know, the 70s probably go to, I would say, the Steelers. They were the, you know, that was the Steel Curtain, the 70s Steelers. You got Mean Joe Green, Jack Lambert, Jack Ham, Elsie Greenwood. Just mean motherfuckers. Is their only goal in every waking second of that game was to separate the quarterback's nose from his face, which usually was in the form of a Roger Staubach, right? So the 70s kind of belonged to the, well, they came out seemingly the most, well, they won the most of the 70s era. By beating Dallas twice and the Vikings once, they won three, even though Miami won two in the 70s, Dallas won two in the 70s. But Pittsburgh, I guess you would have to give the 70s over to the Steelers. And then the 80s would be probably the Niners. You know, you got like, they won their first one in 82 against the Bengals. Then they beat Miami in 85. And then they beat the Bengals again in 89. So they kind of come out, even though, like, let's see, who else kind of had some success? Raiders won a couple as the Oakland Raiders in 1981. And then again as the LA Raiders in 84. But other than that, you know, Washington won one, two in the 80s. The Raiders won two, but yeah, primarily it was the Niners because they won three. They get the nod. And then the 90s belong to the Cowboys. The Cowboys 2.0, the revamped, coked up 90s Cowboys with Michael Irvin, Troy Aikman, Emmitt Smith, Jay Novacek, you know, those guys. Larry Allen. I don't know. Deion Sanders kind of, I guess you can give him a, I mean, he kind of bounced around. He was kind of, it seemed to me like, as legendary as he was, and he was, I mean, he was very fast. Very fast corner. But it seemed like he just kind of went where the success was. You know? He got out of Atlanta real quick. Nothing was happening there. And then went to the Niners and Cowboys. And and just kind of was a, I don't know, fair weather phenom. So, but yeah, so the 90s belonged to the Cowboys, all right? And, you know, even the Broncos won a couple in the 90s, though. But yeah, no, Dallas, by virtue of 3 wins in the 90s, again, just edging out the other two, the Raiders, Redskins type thing. And then you go to early 2000s, it's all kind of Patriots. I mean, you go to like the Rams winning 2000 over the Titans. I remember watching that game, and the receiver was it, what was his name, Kevin, was it Dyson? Just lunged for that last yard, that last throw from Steve McNair. Got killed by his lady. Got shot by his lady. Steve McNair, the great Steve McNair. Tough motherfucker. They won the first of the 2000s, but then it was like after that, the Ravens beating up on the Giants. Their only Super Bowl loss that I recall. That was a rough team too, the Niners. I mean, the Ravens of 2000. Jesus, they went 3 games that year where they didn't even score and they won. I mean, that's a nasty defense. I distinctly remember them. That was 2001. And then after that, it was all Patriots. You know, you got Brady and the Patriots beating the Rams 2002. Then they skip a year. There's always that weird, like, little glitch year, that weird anomaly year where, like, Tampa Bay sneaks in. The first year John Gruden had the Buccaneers, and they beat up on his old team, the Raiders. It's so funny. Yeah, fucking. They had that Bo Bridges looking coach, the Raiders did. I can't even think of his name. He was so bad. And Rich Gannon, who won the MVP that year, throwing for 4,653 yards, got upended by John Gruden's Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who had just recently, the Bucs had been, their coaching spot had been vacated by Tony Dungy, and Gruden just went in there from the Raiders and just ragdolled his old team because he knew all their schemes. I mean, what else did you expect to happen? My God. But then it was like all New England after that. So New England's like, I would give them the title of gatekeeper of the early 2000s. And then, God, they just went on a run. I mean, Jesus, they just went on a run, like a 20-year run, like where they were in every championship game, every other championship game, every other Super Bowl. Just ridiculous. It's just re-fucking-diculous, you know what I'm saying? With, letting a few squib teams get in here and there, but, you know, Denver stealing one in 2015. Seattle stealing one in 2014. The Packers stealing one 2011 over the Steelers. Odd one. Odd year. Yeah. Saints stealing one. But pretty much, I mean, New England was just a dominating force. Just dominating force. And, but that's what I was, after that I was just one Super Bowl after the other. Just NFL Films presents Kansas City and Minnesota. Baltimore, Dallas, Miami, Miami, Washington, Miami, Minnesota, Pittsburgh, Minnesota, Pittsburgh, Dallas, Oakland, Minnesota, Dallas, Denver. Man, just some great, great rivalries. Pittsburgh, Dallas, always a good rivalry in the 70s. Hated the Steelers, hated Terry Bradshaw. But that guy was, again, not a numbers guy, but he just put it together at the right time. But anyway, yeah, in war. So, but, so that, yeah, that's what you do. That's what you do in between, football weekends is, just watch football. watch old football, you know? Yeah, real students of the sport of geek out, is geek the fuck, just geeking out on NFL Films Presents. If you know who, and you know who you are. But I'm saying, yeah, this Super Bowl, I could give a flying fuck. We already saw this one. The Chiefs are going to upend the Niners. It's just, I mean, they just are. The Chiefs, this is the Chiefs dynasty. This is the Chiefs. This is going to be their run. What do you want to call it? The 2020 dynasty? If you give the Patriots all of kind of pretty much most of the 2000s, you got to give the Chiefs from about 2020 on, right? Because they were, they finally won their first one, they beat the Minnesota Vikings. They just kind of embarrassed them back in 1970, but since then, it was a long, dry spell, until they beat the Niners in 2020, and then they got a rude awakening the next season when somehow Brady and the Bucks beat the Chiefs in the Super Bowl without even letting them score a touchdown. 31-9. That was the only Super Bowl that didn't come down to like a field goal for Brady, other than like when he beat the Rams in his last Super Bowl as a Patriot. But even then, that was a 10-point margin. That's not much. Everything else prior to that was always like a, 8-point, 6-point, 3-point, 4-point, 3-point, just coming down to the, it's the beauty of that game. I mean, shit, Brady could have been, he's 7-3, career in Super Bowls, but he just as well could have been 3-7. It just came down to it. But the Chiefs, they're the team of the 2020s, but I'm just kind of already burnt out on them. Tired of looking at that cauliflower, that broccoli-headed fucking quarterback. He's great. He's the only one that can kind of sniff at any of Brady's records. But I'm tired of Brittany Mahomes. I'm tired of Taylor Swift. I'm tired of, although, you know what? I mean, you got to give it to the guy. He's got the pedigree. His dad seems a man of few words, but he was a good, I remember him now. I remember him as a middle reliever for the Minnesota Twins. He was a very good pitcher, very good. So he's got that athletic DNA, right? I was talking to my mom on the way up to Grass Valley about this article I saw about Peter Thiel wanting to do an Olympics all steroids, all roided out. And why not? What a great idea. I mean, it might be clunky at first, It might be a little weird. Everybody's on steroids. But to rival the Olympics, because right now the Olympics are like, okay. I mean, it's kind of like a nice tradition, nice ceremony, nice ritual. Every 4 years, just like leap year, just like the election year. And, but it's like some of them are doped up, some aren't. Who are? How do you know? But if they're all doped up, let's go. I want to see somebody do a fucking 12-foot high jump. I want to see the first guy to break 9 in the 100 meters, I want to see the first guy to break 26 in the 10,000 meters. Let's go. Fuck it. Let's quit fucking around. You know, we're going into, this is the new era. This is the new era. The new era of athletics is like, you know, finding them, stacking, creating these athletes, creating like these CRISPR athletes, you know, these genetically modified freaks, these metahumans, right? And melding of, you know, the biological to the digital. That's already happened, you know, with that, with the Neuralink chip implant. And now we got all these scientists and engineers in China, probably out here doing these CRISPR experiments, just gene editing, just creating like genetic mutants. Let's go. Put them in some spikes, give them some steroids, put them out on the quarter mile track. Let's go. You know, let's see the first 3 minute mile, right? Instead of guessing who's roided up and who isn't, you know, all these athletes, all these record holders from the 80s that are just like, you know, that snuck in under the wire, under the radar, with these PEDs. Now let's give them all, just make it mandated. Just inject these motherfuckers, right? Let's just watch a freak show. I think it's a good idea. I think it's, you know, it's almost an inevitability. I like it. Peter Thiel, you freak. You freaking venture capitalist freak. You fucking PayPal creating, fucking Tesla funding, multi-billionaire Donald Trump campaign supporting freak. Let's go. Let's fucking, the Olympics on steroids. It's finally, hear me out. Special Olympics on steroids. Why not? Fuck it. But, yeah. Maybe that's the new era, you know? It's like, it dawned on me, like, when I was watching the Kings game, you know? We're just, you know, tens of thousands of people packed inside of an arena just watching metahumans just kind of put a ball in a hole and then screaming when it happens. Very Hunger Games. But let's go. Let's make it freaky. Let's make it as freaky as possible. Fuck it. Let's just get all Hunger Games-y on all this shit. Let's just get to the point. Let's just fucking get to the point, right? And with that, I'll leave you guys with chewing on the visual notion of just some roided out woman, metahuman, who just fucking long jumped 35 feet, you know, and just fucking landed on somebody in the middle of an 800 meter race because they just ran out of runway and sand. Fuck it, let's go. All right, I gotta go. So anyway, that's what's up. Hope you enjoyed your non-football weekend this weekend. Congratulations to Connor Mance and all you other weirdos out there preparing for this year of our Lord 2024, this creepy, weird leap year, election year, Olympic year. All right, that's it. I gotta go. I'll talk at you later. Arrivederci, babies. You know, man.